Well, it's Geography Awareness Week, and it's this week, and it's GIS Day tomorrow. So, hey, what better time than to call attention to the power of mapping and the different applications of geographic information systems, or GIS. And by the way, GIS Day is celebrated around the world, not just here in the U.S. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. GIS helps us understand where best to build a wind farm. It might predict where lava flows. It plans the most efficient bus route. It tells me how to I get to my daughter's next basketball game. And I bet it helps you out as well. It can do a whole lot of things. And we're talking with a couple of GIS experts today to talk about all the things it can do. Donna Gensmer is director of the Cartography and GIS Center at UW-Milwaukee, where she's also a geography lecturer in the College of Letters and Sciences. She chairs the Geographic Information Systems Council at UW-Milwaukee and has a 38-year career in GIS. She joins us from our studios in Milwaukee. And Donna, welcome to the program.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thanks a lot for being with us today. I was thinking back, 38 years. GIS been going on that long? It's amazing. Adam Smith with us as well. Let me get him introduced as well. He is a project manager, certified photogrammetrist. That's a hard word to say. Photogrammetrist with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, where he's worked in surveying and mapping for 18 years. He's graduated from UW-River Falls, has a master's degree in infrastructure systems engineering from the University of Minnesota. And he's joining us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Adam, welcome to you.
Hey, Larry. Don't worry. A lot of people have a hard time saying photogrammetrist.
Photogrammetrist. You don't want to look at the word. I mean, you're better off not to look at the word when you're pronouncing it, or you better have a phonetic spelling, that's for sure. Well, we'll find out what the heck a photogrammetrist does with him and a whole lot more as we talk with the both of them. And I hope you'll join in with your questions, comments, experiences. You can reach us at 800-642-1234 as you listen in. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. How do you use GIS in your life or in your work? What questions do you have about applying spatial data to lots of different things? Join in, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Donna, let's give us a working knowledge of GIS. What is it?
You had an excellent definition where you started out the show. It is computer software data, combining it to create solutions for various problems. And one of the things that distinguishes GIS from other analytical approaches is its connection to location. You're looking at where things are happening and their relationships to each other spatially.
Well, it's a, you know, I could hardly believe that somebody's been going at this for 38 years. What's the history of GIS? Where did it come from?
Well, when I started out, it was not using computers. A lot of it was, pen and ink and, doing the math by hand. It's some people who started thinking about relationships and how we might approach things better, smarter, to come up with proposals for solutions in our world.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking that this just didn't come from one discipline, did it? It must have come from a number of disciplines.
Indeed, yes. So spatially, we think a lot about geography. You could think about landscape architecture. With this aspect of using computer software, computer science, data analysis, statistics. There's all those fields that came together to work at creating this sort of analysis.
Yeah,
but it's applicable to so many different questions.
Yeah. So what's the range? Can you give us a range of some of the applications? Go ahead. Sorry.
So emergency management, urban planning, agriculture. It's used in farming. You can do more precise applications of either fertilizer, other augmentations to farm fields. So a tractor can actually precisely deliver things based on an analysis of a specific farm field.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing thing. I have a friend who's literally could drive his combine, wouldn't have to use the steering wheel. I mean, the applications, I mean, he can put fertilizer, a little more fertilizer in some parts of the soil and less fertilizer in others without having to do it manually. It's all kind of done for him. Adam, you are a certified photogrammetrist. What the heck is that?
So I get that question quite a bit.
I bet you do.
Yeah, especially at, you know, outings and stuff like kids' school functions. Parents are usually like, I'm an accountant or I'm a teacher. I'm like, yeah, I'm a photogrammetrist. And they just look at me, a photo what? So anyways, photogrammetry kind of falls underneath a couple umbrellas. It falls underneath the GIS umbrella, but then it also goes under surveying. In fact, a lot of people refer to it as aerial surveying. And photogrammetrists, we specialize in imagery. And the imagery typically comes from either satellites, a manned aircraft, and more recently, drones as well. We also specialize in laser sensor data. So there's these awesome sensors out there that we can mount onto aircraft, moving vehicles on the ground, boats, trains, and they can produce sometimes over 1 million points per second. And these points bounce off of surfaces and return and produce an XYZ point for each time it does. And so we can take this data from this imagery or from these sensors, and we can make measurements or 2D, 3D maps of the Earth's surface and features on it. And that's, in a nutshell, kind of what a photogrammetrist does.
As you were talking about that, I was thinking about my own history with it, and I had... I was kind of a deer hunter and spent a lot of time in the Shawamigan National Forest where you're maybe a mile or so off a road. And so early on, years ago, we had the maps. We had some photos that we had of the area. We had some geographic maps of the landscape and used those a lot in navigating around the Shawamigan National Forest. And now I have something on my phone that's called Hunt Wild, and I can turn it on, and I instantly get a picture of where I'm sitting from the air. And that's the extent, you know, you wonder, what could possibly go beyond that? Is there anything that could go beyond that, Adam?
Well, I mean, that is kind of the stuff that we work with. We do take it a little further. I work for a DOT, and so the data that we're collecting is usually a little higher, a little bit better resolution than what you would see typically. But I mean, it's amazing the analytics that can be performed when you put, you know, databases and mix it with a map and create calculations, and it is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think when most people, or many people at least, think about GIS, the thought immediately goes to the GPS in your car or in your phone, because it involves mapping. What's the difference between GIS and GPS, Adam?
Yeah, sure. So GPS is referring to networks of satellites that are orbiting the planet, which send down signals to receivers, which can give an XYZ location. And now this can be very helpful in a GIS. So now GIS is more of you have, let's refer right back to that. We're talking about the navigation scenario. This will be a good explanation.
Okay.
So you have your little interface, you have your map, and then you have the GPS, which is sending a signal of where you're located, and then you have a database of locations of where you want to go to. So you put it all together, and then that's your navigation system, which is technically a GIS, and you're utilizing GPS within that GIS, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Donna, let me turn to you for a minute. You like to try to have your students stump you about fields where GIS is not in use. Have you ever been at a loss for areas of the workforce that GIS doesn't touch?
I have not been stumped yet.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, what are some let's take that further. What are some common applications for GIS that we might not notice in our lives? Talk a bit more about that.
Well, there is emergency management. It is either very visible in your life when you need it, or perhaps not as visible right at the moment. So being able to understand where emergencies are happening, working with the logistics of managing an emergency, managing relief. Also for planning, you know, you may not be in an emergency right now, but you can work out some plans. So that's one big use. City planning, we can think about how our different land uses we have in the city or in a rural area. And think about what is our vision for that area, and look at how things fit together spatially to come up with plans to move forward.
You know, Kate Archer Kent told me, she said, you know, that she found out that GIS can help dentists find cavities. I said, you're kidding me. Is that right? Could GIS, I mean, if I was going to try and stump you, I'd say, well, what about using GIS to help figure out my cavities?
Well, she actually shared that article with me in advance. And, so looking at a tooth and looking at the different qualities of what's happening with the tooth, you can start predicting where there might be an issue. So it's all spatial.
Let's give our listeners a chance to join in today. We're talking with our two guests, Donna Gensmer, Director of Cartology and GIS Center at UW-Milwaukee. She's also a geography lecturer in the College of Letters and Sciences there. Adam Smith is a project manager, certified photogrammetrist with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. He's surveying and mapping. He's been doing it for 18 years, graduate of UW River Falls. What questions do you have about GIS or maybe GPS as well? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we're going to go to Anthony in Lake Delton in Wisconsin. But first, I want to remind you that Natalie Guyette is our on-air producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We are taking a look at GIS today, Geographic Information Services, with our guest, two guests, as a matter of fact, Dennis Gensmer and Donna Gensmer, excuse me, and Adam Smith. Great to have both of them with us today, and certainly you can join in with your own questions or comments about GIS, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go now to Anthony in Lake Delton. Anthony, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, hello. Thank you for having me. I wanted to explore a little bit of the paradigm of GIS. It seems to me that there's a lot of data that is tied geographically to place and time. And I was wondering if the guests consider themselves historians as well as prognosticators. Data tied to place is static. People are mobile. The information they create goes across the world in space and time, backwards and forwards. We saw that with the election. Although the people and the information were democratic, they were not used democratically. This historical tying to time, we see this data was created in the past, taking it into the future. How do we delineate our historical perspective?
Interesting. Let's see, Donna, do you want to take a crack at that?
So we can take our data and we can look for trends and look at the different variables and see how they are playing together and try and make predictions for the future.
That makes some sense. Adam, something to add to that?
You know, I don't consider myself a historian, and I mean that's a very good question, but I guess that's probably not in my specialty. I'll leave it to Donna.
Okay. So we take a look. So in other words, Donna, you look at the historical trends, and then you use that to predict the future.
Correct. You can also bring variables together and try, you know, if you don't have something historical, you can try looking at different scenarios to try and predict what might happen.
Anthony, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I had a question about the evolution of routing algorithms. I guess it seemed, you know, a long time ago, it seemed they were all homespun by the different mapping entities, and I'm wondering if there's any sort of consortium or entity or group that's trying to standardize or share data. I mean, now we have lots of traffic data, but a lot of it's still under proprietary systems like Google or Waze or things like that, and cities have stuff. I'd just like to hear your comments about where you see that going.
Donna, let's go to you. Donna?
Routing is not my area of expertise, but my understanding is that, yes, it is still proprietary. There is a lot of research going on, people trying to understand better different routing decisions. Adam's with the DOT.
Yeah, Adam, what have you got there?
Also not my specialty, but however, I know that there is a little bit of crossing to versus public use, you know, for routing, for commercial use, and then also like the emergency vehicle type stuff, the E911. So that's another group that, and I believe their data has to be uniform and a certain format and standard to it. And I'm not sure about the commercial end of it.
Well, I would say anything that's governmental would not be proprietary, would it?
That's correct. If it's governmental, then it is not proprietary. It's open to the public.
Yeah. So, and that makes certainly, you would hope it would all be open to the public anyway. Vicki in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. I am calling with what I think might be a fairly common problem, and I use GPS all the time. But I hope that they're talking with students and such about using your mind first. We have a real problem. We live in the country, but it's not a remote area. We're like 10 miles west of Madison. And just this morning, and this happens with some regularity because there's a housing development next to us, and that's been there quite a while. It's not like it's brand new, but this huge dump truck loaded with a huge load of black dirt is up our driveway. Well, it's a long driveway, so by the time I heard him, he's most of the way up here, and he's looking a little puzzled because there's obviously no construction going on, but he had to turn around, and we have huge ruts now in the grass, and, you know, he apologized, but he just, you know, and the number, our numbers are clearly posted at the end of the driveway, both on a fire, you know, a fire pole and the mailbox. And it's just, excuse me, I was on the treadmill, so I'm out of breath. But, you know, I don't, people need to use their mind first. And if the numbers don't match, don't drive up, especially if you're driving a great big vehicle.
Well, Donna, that's a good point. And I've actually, that's happened to me where GPS was telling me something, and I said, well, that's not right. I went ahead and used my bean. But do you talk about that with your students?
I do. I also talk about the fact that as individuals, we all, our brains work differently. We use different ways for wayfinding. Some of us may be looking at roads and being very, very conscious of where we are on a road. Some of us are using landmarks, using a familiar building to help understand where we need to turn. There's just so many different ways that individuals wayfind. So, yes, we all need to experience the other ways and keep practicing them. But I'm assuming that we had people making wrong turns as much before as we do now.
Probably. Maybe it's less now. You would hope anyway. Rich in Bosque Bell, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Oh, hi, Larry. I just have a question that comes up once in a while when I'm driving for my job and I'm using GPS to find a place I've never been before. And sometimes it will tell me, it can't find a way there. What's going on?
Adam?
I haven't experienced that yet, but I would assume that it just has to do with that database again, that, you know, it either couldn't find or make that routing connection from where you are versus where you need to go.
Yeah, that's pretty much my experience. I can remember driving on a new road here in Wisconsin, and the GPS didn't have that road. And I looked at the map, and the map is showing me driving across essentially what would be open fields, and in one case, at one point, a river without having a road there. And it was a brand new road. It just hadn't been entered into the database, I assumed. And I guess that sounds about right, Adam.
That would be my assumption as well. Something was messed up in the database, and it couldn't draw that connection.
Yeah, there you go. There you go, Rich. Thanks. Let's go to Mike in Madison.
Hi. Sorry. I'm calling about whether GIS can be used at all for locating the prime sources of, you know, where most of the greenhouse gases are coming from around the world, and differentiate between what kinds are which, and also the sources, what kinds of sources they're coming from.
Yeah, that's interesting too. What do you think, Donna?
Yes, looking at sampling the greenhouse gases and where they are in their concentrations. Yes, that's spatial, and we can use GIS to look at how it, where it is now, how it's expanding, look at other variables that may be sources that may be contributing to the expansion of greenhouse gases. So, yes, that is an application.
And it is being used right now. Are organizations doing that? And I'm, you know, I'm thinking climate change here.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Mike, it can be done, and it is being done, apparently. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Gene in Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Gene.
Well, I have a few comments. Number one, I've been blind for 65 years, but I've been my family navigator since I was about age 6. So spatial orientation has been very important to me. But my second comment is for people using electronic navigation system, it's absolutely imperative that they have an updated system. We had friends who tried to travel to northern Minnesota last spring to get to the Twin Cities and discover too late that 3 of the I-35 bridges were closed at the same time. It took them 3.5 hours to get through the Twin Cities. So having an updated system is imperative.
Good points. And Adam, maybe a comment from you on that.
Sure. It's also important to be able to look out and find applications that give you certain data. For instance, in that circumstance, Minnesota Department of Transportation has an app and a web page out there where it's a live map that shows road closures. You can click on it, get attribute information, tells you some details of when they're closed and that kind of stuff. However, not everyone knows what's out there unless you're looking for it and searching for that particular use.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of applications out there, but you have to search.
Well, he's absolutely right about, you know, the GPS system, for example, that comes in your car. If you don't update that, that needs to be updated regularly, and it's typically, if I'm not mistaken, a fairly expensive procedure to do it, maybe $200-$300 just to update. And so I'm more likely to use something like Google Maps. What do you think of Google Maps, Adam?
You know, it's pretty impressive. It does a pretty good job. I mean, there's been times where we'll be driving somewhere, kind of a longer trip, and we know where we're going, but we have navigation on anyways, just in case an accident or something pops up. And there's been quite a few times where all of a sudden, you know, it's taken us off of the highway onto some little roads, and sure enough, there's an accident occurred, and, you know, there's a 20-minute wait up ahead. So some of that real-time stuff does come into the Google Maps application. I use it. My wife uses it. It's good for certain circumstances, I guess.
Yeah, it's one of the go-tos for me. But thanks, Gene, for calling. Appreciate it. Bob in Richland Center, it's your turn.
Yeah, well, thank you. My question is if either of the guests have any experience or have been helping out with the NG911 system that's been coming. I know Minnesota and Wisconsin is currently working on bringing those upgrades to the 911 system. And if they have, or just even the comments on the challenges between different formats that different communities use in how they label streets and center lines, whether it's they're spelling the entire word out for Second Street or they're just using the numbers, you know, 2ND and Second Street, and if any of those format changes have been any challenges or questions to them.
Interesting. Donna, a comment from you first, perhaps, and then on to Adam.
I'm not immediately involved in the E911 updates. I was actually at a meeting last week where the Milwaukee County municipal governments were discussing that it's coming up. Standardization is very important in order to get things to work together. So whether it's E911 or many other things, those things need to be standardized. There are many people working on this, and as with many other technologies. I don't see this as really being an issue of implementing. Sometimes it takes time. People need to come up with these standards, but it's perfectly implementable.
Yeah, it shouldn't. It shouldn't be. I mean, you have to just get agreements from everybody, and you know, electronically and everything else. It shouldn't take that long once you have a standard and everybody follows the same standard. I would think, Adam.
I know that we spend a lot of time on standards, and I'm not directly involved in this either. And you know, there could be some situations too where it's going between different government levels. You know, you have standards on the federal level, the state level, the city level, all the way down. And you know, there could be some disconnect there, even though, I mean, really it should start from the top and trickle down and all be standardized. I'm not an expert on it, I can't say for sure, but I know that our DOT, that there's a ton of time spent into standardizing and getting things correct.
Yeah, it makes sense. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Mike in Oshkosh, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. I was wondering if your guests could comment on the national security implications of the availability of all of this information, not only to Americans, but also to our potential adversaries.
Hmm. All right. Donna, do you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. There is a sort of a subgroup of GIS professionals who are thinking more out from the national security aspect. So more of geospatial intelligence. So while I'm not working with it directly, I know they are looking at it. There have been times when there are places on imagery, aerial imagery, where things will be blurred out. So the general population, if we're going to use Google Maps for an example, where you may be looking over a specific area and it may be blurred, so that you can't quite get as much information. It may be a secure location.
Oh, so some military base as a potential example of that, I would assume.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So there are people working on it. Mike, thank you for calling. Amy in Iola, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Larry. I just thought I would mention a use that I'm doing for GIS. I'm a GIS specialist with a nonprofit organization in Wisconsin, and we monitor all the stormwater runoff that flows in the Fox Basin, which is 6,000 square miles, that flows out through the Bay of Green Bay and the lower Fox River. And I've built applications on some platforms that track all the best management practices placed on the ground by agricultural producers, and it tracks the funding, and it sets up a verification schedule, and so GIS can be really robust. And I just wanted to let you know that there's a lot of things going on out there in the world of GIS.
Oh, that's a very good point. And Donna, just maybe I bet you would agree with Amy on that.
Absolutely. These are some really great examples of all the applications that you can put GIS to for the specific aspect of stormwater runoff.
Yeah, it's great. Well, good work, Amy. Thank you very much for calling. John in Waterloo, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry and guests. I just wanted to give a shout out to a new website that a teacher friend of mine told me about. It's great for kids and for adults too, and it's called Mapcaso, or Mapcaso, like Picasso, but with a map in front of it, mapcaso.com. And what it is, it's an interactive map where you can doodle, make your plans or draw on it, and share it with other people. It's a lot of fun. I think kids would really enjoy it. and it brings in the whole geography and mapping, you know, gives them something to focus on.
Map Caso. So MAPCASO.com.
Yep, that's correct. Yep. Just started up, and it's a lot of fun to use, and I just wanted to give your audience a chance to experience it.
Well, I appreciate the call. Donna, have you used that with your students yet?
No, I've not.
So,
I think I've seen it, but I have not used it.
But it sounds like... Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just... It was reminding me of SimCity, where kids or adults can go in and make little adjustments and see how the city changes. You know, that's also very spatial.
So SimCity is S-Y-M-C-I-T-Y?
S-I-M-C-I-T-Y.
S-I-M-C-I-T-Y. Well, this is fun. As you think about the future here, what's on the horizon? Do you guys think, Adam? What about you?
Well, there's a lot of talk about computer vision and artificial intelligence, and I've kind of been watching too. I mean, software, hardware, everything is progressing really fast right now, and it's amazing what's advanced in the last 5 or 10 years, and I imagine it's just going to continue on. And I think we're going to see more applications, more web-based stuff, access to more GIS-type tools.
Yeah, and Donna, you're probably agreeing with that. Anything to add to that?
I am agreeing. You know, virtual reality, the increased use of drones to collect data. One thing we're trying to do is get GIS and spatial analysis used more in middle school and high schools. A colleague and I are conducting a week-long workshop for middle and high school teachers coming up in June to introduce additional ways for teachers to increase students' knowledge, and skill levels and awareness of geospatial careers.
That sounds pretty cool. How do people find out more about getting involved in that?
The website's pretty easy. It's uwm.edu/POD. Stands for Power of Data.
So uwm.edu/POD?
Correct. POD, Power of Data.
Power of Data. Well, there's a lot of power in data, Donna and Adam, and thank you so much for taking time to be with us today and talk about GIS on this whole week devoted to geography and Geography Awareness Week. Great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Larry. Thank you for having us.
Donna Gensmer is Director of Cartography and GIS Center at UW-Milwaukee, where she's also a geography lecturer in the College of Letters and Sciences. Also chairs the Geographic Information Systems Council at UW-Milwaukee. Adam Smith is a project manager and a certified photogrammetrist with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Well, it's great to have them along, and it's great, I think, to be looking ahead to what we've got coming up, because next we're going to be talking about exploring the challenges of our Great Lakes. That next, here on the Ideas Network.